Hey, buttheads, welcome back to Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead. My name is Richard. Hey, Kyle, what's up, bud?
Hey, Richard, how's it going?
Coming in hot this morning. I had enough coffee, and I'm drinking my smoothie, and today is, it's a big day.
Nice.
There's an election happening, which we're not going to talk too much about.
We were just discussing, very appropriate that we did this episode today, as today is election day. So we currently, it is the morning, we don't know how the election will turn out. So if there's a weird energy, it's that energy that you will feel permeating every second of this episode. But really, you know, who cares?
So we're kicking this episode is going to shift us into maybe an alternate timeline.
We don't know. Into the Biff universe. We are discussing Back to the Future 2. A world where cop cars are burning in the streets and where there's big casinos everywhere and
schools
are on fire. And our schools are unoccupied and just, all of that.
There's nuclear waste facilities everywhere, burning flames coming off towers and exhaust. Yeah. It's all gross. Mm-hmm. There's bikers everywhere. This was an interesting one to revisit because this... Mm-hmm. This one I was always my favorite when I was younger, because they went back in time to the first movie, which we can talk about. But I loved as a child the fact that they went into the first movie, and I also loved the hoverboards and stuff. But the thing that I loved was Marty's costume, and then Marty seeing Marty always registered really well for me as a kid. But I hadn't seen this in maybe 20 years. It's been long time. Yeah.
Really? Okay, I didn't realize you hadn't. I revisited this a bunch of times, so it's interesting. So why for the first time in 20 years? Was this just not one you... Did you watch it a lot when you were a kid?
This one I watched a lot when I was a kid. I didn't watch the... We owned the third one. The third one was the only one we owned officially on VHS.
Oh,
I don't think... We didn't have the second one, but we had the first one recorded when I visited my grandma. My dad, like, copied it to... recorded it onto the VHS, so that's how we had it. So I had the first in the third, but I didn't have access to the second, so I always loved it so much. But when I was younger, I always felt like the third one was the boring one because it was a Western, and those were
not cool in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. They were just boring, and I was I was 5 years old, so you know, stupid.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, so it was really interesting to watch this one, and the hoverboard stuff is great. That holds up super well. And man, the first half of this movie is pretty freaking dark. I was not expecting how dark it went. I mean, and Back to the Future 1 has those dark elements in it, but they're kind of beneath the surface. And this one, the first half of the movie, it's just kind of...
Yeah. Yeah, a big part. Well, I mean, a big part even of the first film, though it's done obviously a bit more subtly, though not very subtle at all in the first film, is that idea that Marty lives in a bit of a shabby, dark present, you know, a dark which we accept just as the nature of reality with it being, you know, 1985, and it was the first film. But then, of course, we then see the shinier version of Hill Valley when he returns at the end of the film. So it's already kind of playing in that world of there being kind of these alternate versions of all of that. But yeah, but to talk about it was interesting visiting this film again now, because there's been a lot of talk the last couple of years that obviously fixate on, you know, sneakers and hoverboards. Yep. And it is kind of shocking how much stuff made it deep, just embedded itself in the cultural zeitgeist because of this movie. And I think that, you know, Zemeckis has this interesting and highly influential place in culture where he creates these things, especially the shoes, which now exist, and all of these other things. And I don't think we need to spend too much time on that, considering how much time has been spent on that recently. But it is interesting to think about. It's one thing for any film to enter to be remembered, to live on beyond the year it's released. It's another thing for a film to, especially a sequel, you know, which has certain things going for it, but also has certain things going against it, in that it's dabbling in a lot of the iconography from the first film, a lot of the same images. I mean, it's one thing for a film to introduce any doohickey, you know, any piece of technology or any iconography that just stays with people.
Right.
But this one, between hoverboards and lace-up shoes and what is the other thing? There's a few other things throughout this film that are escaping me at the moment. even the Cubs winning, you know, all sorts of things that were visualized and then came to be later on. Which also speaks to the power of movies, and I mean that in a really kind of a serious way, and that, you know, people made a lot of hay over the fact that the flip phone is of course based on the Star Trek communicator, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff, and we realize that these visions for the future that we are creating, and this certainly was an extremely potent one, because I watched this a lot when I was a kid, and this is what I just accepted that the future was gonna look like, and it burned into my brain when I was a kid. And so it's interesting how much of that, you know, and I wouldn't even say, well, just sort of happened coincidentally, but how many images were, you know, were potent enough that people have spent decades, years, either subconsciously or not, trying to actually bring Back to the Future into existence. It. And it may look as if it's going to actually happen, Richard.
Well, I mean, the other thing is we have weird robot servers now. There's a whole bunch of restaurants that, especially now, mm-hmm. that have just taken you order off of a screen on your table. There's not a... Michael Jackson or Reagan aren't taking your order, but I mean,
one of the most almost kind of darkly prophetic moments, and it was funny because I got to bust out my old Blu-ray set, and I was sort of clicking through the special features, and I watched some deleted scenes and everything, which was interesting because I have just because I wanted to dig a little bit more into, you know, some of the thinking behind how the movie came about, which I actually want to get into, because I actually brought up some really some things that answer a lot of questions for me about this movie.
I don't think I have access to that, so I'm curious to hear.
We'll dig into that in just a second. But now I've lost my train of thought. What were we just talking about, Richard?
You said you watched some deleted scenes, which provided context.
So one of the scenes was an extended version of Marty entering and talking. The older Marty, we're diving in. We should take a big step back here and sort of tee up the whole movie. But one of the most interesting moments was this argument between Marty and his son.
Marty Jr.
about him watching like 6 television programs at one time. It's an extension of that shot. And then he's like, hey, listen, when your grandparents are here, we eat at the table. And he throws him that pair of goggles, the glasses he's wearing. And he's like, oh, I can only watch 2 television shows at a time on this. And then we see them at the dining room table with, you know, female Marty with her phone covering her phone glasses on. And with Marty, of course, wearing his TV glasses on and not paying attention to their grandparents, not paying attention to the elder Marty, and just being completely absorbed in their little personal screens at the which is just funny because that really struck me this time, because it's a movie, again, I had seen many times. I had not honestly thought too hard about that beat where, oh, you know, they're wearing fun like screen glasses at the table, and then you see, especially in the extended version of the scene, how broken and just dysfunctional, I mean, that's pretty obvious how broken and dysfunctional Marty's family is, and how clearly that element was predicted, that even around the dinner table, and of course this was a joke on TV is rotting kids' brains and they just want to, you know, hook it straight up to their eyeballs and yada yada yada, and yet it puts a really an interesting and kind of dark frame around people around their table staring into their iPhones, which has become increasingly relevant as we all watched The Social Dilemma over the course of the past couple of weeks. Back to the Future, just predicting it all, Richard.
Well, I think that's one of the things that kind of thinking about it makes it so dark. I mean, they actively came out and said they didn't want to do an Orwellian future. They tried to do the opposite of that, and I think that succeeds in a lot of respects. But when you look at like the movie starts with Doc Brown coming back to Marty and Jennifer saying, you've got to come back with me to the future. Something terrible has happened. It's not you, it's your kids. And they were just coming off of this high of Marty just like going back into the past and kind of rekindling his parents' relationship. So we're on a high. Marty has the truck. Everything is going good. We're in the better timeline now. And just they go, assuming that nothing else changes, they have to go to the future because Marty has made this mistake because he doesn't like being called chicken, which one decision kind of ruins his life, essentially, that and just puts them in this kind of where he's almost like making the same mistakes that his parents made. And so that's all projected. And it's like, whoa, like one thing can change everything. We're on this high. Yeah. There's nothing he can do to stop it, really. It's
And of course, the idea that it very strongly parallels, obviously, it's the inverted trajectory of George McFly in the first film, you know, who starts out as a dweeb, but then has that right moment that sort of sets him on the right path. And the idea that, of course, Marty has the inverse of that. And that was honestly the first thing that struck me. So, of course, just to, you know, it's Back to the Future 2, Bob Zemeckis or Bob Gale, they're asked to make a sequel. They bring on Doc and Marty. They get Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd to sign on. They're writing their movie and all of that. And one of the things when my experience watching it this time, especially right on the heels of kind of really digging into Back to the Future 1 a bit, was how that the first adventure into the future. And it's impossible to get perspective on this because the first adventure to the future is so much about just the experience of seeing this kind of silly, all logos and jokes and commercial stuff, glossy version of Hill Valley in the future. But the actual plot, the actual what's at work is very, almost intentionally, very trivial. They're like going there to get Marty's son out of some trouble with the thing that ultimately it feels a bit forced to just try and get everyone there. And you can even hear them talk about the fact that it's sort of an extension of them just wanting to do an extension directly of that beat at the end of the previous film, which is another choice that, again, when I was a kid, it almost didn't make sense. And it's something I've thought about as an adult, like, man, they reshot all of that stuff beat for beat. Mm-hmm. You heard Zemeckis saying that they wanted to pick, you know, kind of right up where the previous film ended, and so they have the girlfriend in the car, and even them reshooting everything. You know, when I was a kid, and even beyond that, you think, like, my God, why would they reshoot everything? And then it's been very interesting. I mean, obviously, they're changing actresses, but, you know, it's one of those things that seeing it in sequence now, you realize that so much of there's what we've talked about a lot, which is the kind of show-offiness, the kind of playful show-offiness of Zemeckis's frames and Zemeckis's cinema. And you can tell that he's the kind of filmmaker who wouldn't, you know, who would enthusiastically take up the challenge of reshooting that entire beat up to that point to kind of help pull off the magic trick of the movie, to kind of seamlessly weave the things together. Right. And it seems like much of where even we went in the future and in the past is about, again, weaving that fantastic magic trick, which was, again, very, very new at the time of seeing a different, you know, Eddie Murphy, the Clumps, has done it so much now, but seeing multiple actors being played or one actor playing multiple characters on screen at the same time. So I don't know. It was interesting. So,
I think that kind of struck me too on rewatch. And, it's the, one of the weaker parts of the film is kind of shoehorning Elizabeth Shue, into the movie, and they've come out and said, like, oh man, if we knew we were going to make a sequel, we would have never put Jennifer in the car. And then the movie is kind of actively trying to get her out of the way the entire movie. With even lines of Doc Brown saying, oh, she's not that important to my plan. Like just weird decisions of like zonking her out and then leaving her in an alley. so she can be picked up by the cops to be taken to their future home, so she can see all the things. And then they just leave her in the alternate timeline, which is totally, that felt like to me the moment where Rick and Morty was born, when they just kind of leave her, and it's like, oh, it'll be fine. She'll pop up when we fix everything.
We'll fix everything later on. It was interesting looking at it this time because, as opposed to the first film starts out generating, and this makes actually sense as a sequel, but it definitely is a different viewing experience. And I don't think I was ever as aware of it as I was this time, kind of seeing it after having dove into the first episode a couple times now, as we keep digging back into it on more episodes. But the first part of the film in the future is delightful and fascinating and all jokes, but as opposed to the first film, which is full of a lot of empathy for Marty in that first chunk, in that first, you know, bit. We're kind of seeing how his life isn't quite working out. We're getting back on board with him. Now, people, you know, having waited several years for a sequel, getting a chance to see Marty in the future, getting to see the power laces and the hoverboard and all the flying cars and shit for the first time, I'm sure, as was the case with me when I was a kid, the first part of the film was my favorite part of the film. It's like, oh, look at all these new images, all this new, a whole new vision for that was distinct from the first film, which I kind of will kind of get into in a moment. Sure. That part of why I loved all of the, there's no way else to describe it, all of the Back to the Futuring that happens in the last half of Back to the Future 2, because lots of other people, everything from the latest Avengers movies to Time Crimes, has indulged in Back to the Futuring, and this film does that. You know, it has Marty weaving around, and that was very unique. And yet this time watching it through, I found myself realizing that, oh man, all of the energy when I was a kid about Back to the Future 2 was seeing all of these new images, both the future world and then the Biff world, and then all of the incredibly fun machinations where he re-enters the thing, which again basically, I mean, it's kind of created something, again, it's hard to get perspective on because it was the first time, certainly, I was seeing anything like it. Mm-hmm. But we've seen it now so many times, characters weaving their way back in through previous stories. Like I said, it's Avengers. It's been done in all kinds of movies.
Harry Potter does it.
Harry Potter does it quite a bit. Does a lot. It's almost like every franchise has to have now their Back to the Future sequence, where you dive into a previous sequel.
The Back to the Future. It's not just the Back to the Future. Yes. It's the Back to the Future 2.
It's the Back to. No, exactly. But that actually is a very good point, because all of that stuff, so many things we associate, you know, as being an iconic part of Back to the Future, like the hoverboard, but also like all the weird time machinations and running around, all comes from this film, and yet, when looking at it this time, the film felt very front-loaded to me, in the sense that it was like, I and it's tough because it's hard to re-experience that for the first time, but you see this vision of the future, which is very, very cool and flashy, though it maybe lacks the kind of empathy-generating engine that was there in the first film, but it saves that because it knows a moment later it's going to deliver you this dark vision of the future. The only thing I felt really that I wish I would have seen in that, it took me a long time. I didn't figure out until this time what felt like it was missing from that future, from that future world, was Marty seeing Marty. You know, it was Marty seeing the loop, like that moment that he had with George McFly, and then in this movie is given to him seeing his son, but his son ultimately really doesn't factor into much for the rest of the film. Would have been a moment where Marty sees the sad, like the all that stuff they give to Elizabeth Shue, sneaking around the house, seeing how it all worked out. I just wish we had seen Marty do that in that first act, because I loved all the jokes about the future and I love all that stuff, but I'm remembering back how lost Marty feels in the first part of the first film, and how much empathy we have for him because of how lost he feels, because it's not just an issue of like most people would say, he doesn't have the truck for the weekend or whatever. It's about him losing confidence in his father and therefore the world around him and all of this. And what would be, and clearly it's baked into this film, a perfect parallel for that is him losing faith in the idea of his own future and what he's going to do, and in a sense maybe gaining respect back for his parents and how they fought out of that. And I know there's a lot of weird circumstances going into making this movie, like Crispin Glover not being available. But the thing that I came across, and I know I'm sure I probably went in one ear and out the other with this movie the first time I heard it, but it was really interesting to hear it this time, was that the original draft that Bob Gale put together while Zemeckis was doing Roger Rabbit was set in the past. The third act was not set in 1950s. Yeah. It was set in 1967. And I just cannot hear that without immediately wishing that were the movie that we had seen. And again, I'm pulled in two directions, because at the same time, what seems this point that is clearly incredibly delightful and complex and fun about all those sequences where he returns to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance that I loved when I was a kid, again, largely, I think, would just got kind of compressed out of my mind, because you would kind of half remember the first film, you'd half remember some stuff from the second film, and then it's like, oh yeah, Marty was there too. And I'm sure it was a delightful experience, but it would quickly get compressed out of my mind, and I would only remember the future and the dark alternate world, which we'll get into. But, you know, it's 1967. It just feels like such the right answer for this sequel for this thing that I can't help but want to go back in time and if you will, to get into a DeLorean and go back and grab Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale by the shoulders and say, listen, you did the 50s already. And all of this doohickery is going to be very, very delightful, but might be somewhat banal in a couple of years. And man, it's just the potency of both a completely new set of iconography, seeing Marty in, you know, the 60s, seeing him, you know, seeing Lorraine in the 60s. Like, I believe what Bob Gale said, I think, was that, George was going to be maybe it's something like a professor at Berkeley, yeah, and she was going to be part of the anti-war movement and all of this stuff. And it's like, that is the perfect second next step, you know, based on the content that was there, because in the first film, because they examine this pre, you know, counterculture, pre-1967, pre-1969 version of America, which then we know intellectually is transfigured into the modern America through this particular cultural revolution. And so we, you know, it's like we discuss it all the time. There's the 50s world, and then there's the post-1960s world, and all of that that takes place within. And so I would have loved to have seen Crispin Glover or not being present in the film, you know, Lorraine and George and how their take on it. In fact, this is how into this I was, Richard. I actually took pictures of the screen grabs of some segments from the script as they were popping through on, as I was just revisiting the special features. But Lorraine, Marty, you can't leave. I'll lose my bail money, and think of what it'll do to the movement. Marty, the movement? Lorraine, the anti-war movement. Most people, like my father, think the draft resistors are cowards. They don't understand that there are principles involved. But if you run off, they'll say, see, we told you that he was a coward. You'd be setting a terrible example. And so it's just, again,
I think in terms of how we, like, listening to you say that, like, if we, in a movie that is about alternate timelines and diverging stuff, like, the 60s was the potential moment for that, where we didn't get the counterculture coming to fruition, the culture came through and kind of flattened it out, and it just disappeared into the 80s.
Regardless of what you think about it, it's not just like it's another time period. Like, it's the time, it's a time period that largely represents the nexus of change between the George McFly world of that we see in the first film, and then the kind of fallen world that we see in the beginning, in 1985. And it'll be interesting to see the evolution, not just of where things are plot-wise, they're going back, they're getting an almanac, all of that, but in the same way we saw in I Want to Hold Your Hand, how he was able to subtly show how sexual politics were sort of boiling over in interesting ways and being repressed and all of that. We would have gotten a very, very rich version of the movie, I can only assume, because they were very, very good at what they did. And I feel, can't help but, the mind reels to think about a movie that had, again, a whole nother view of Lorraine, a whole nother view of Marty, and just a whole nother view. I I'm pulled in two directions, because I loved the back half of the first movie when I was a kid. It was delightful and funny and all of that. And now as I watch it, I can't help but want to see, it's like, oh, this is charming and it is a romp. And again, I also feel like this might be a symptom of the fact that it was originally written as one long script where this particular section was going to be, you know, chewed up at some point in an early version of a longer story they were trying to tell that ultimately concludes in the Old West or whatever. But for the third act of the second film, I just would have really loved to have seen just a different era and an era that honestly puts more on Front Street a lot of the themes that the first film was exploring, you know, changing concepts of marriage, gender, masculinity, all of this kind of stuff would have been really, really, really would have been rad. And again, it's one of those things that, so Richard, I've talked for way too long.
Yeah,
you go ahead.
I mean, I kind of been pulled two directions too. And I think I love the fact that they go back in time to the first movie. I always have loved it, but watching the rewatch, it's kind of like I do see your point. And I don't know if you read this, but Zemeckis was the reason that didn't happen. He came in and was like, "Nah, it doesn't work in the 60s. We can't do that. And we have an opportunity here to do something that has never been done in a time travel story and go back into this old thing and kind of have a, I don't know if he said it, but based on watching it, there's this voyeuristic look at the thing that already had happened and seeing everything from a different perspective, which the movie does do very well. And it's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
It's
a great idea. That's why we've seen it 19 times since then. You know?
Right. And just to kind of reiterate, as a kid, I loved, that's what I remember. My strongest memories were him going back and seeing himself play the guitar. Like that, that is the one thing that I remember from this movie. Not really what the plot is or why anything is happening, just Marty in that jacket and that hat and those sunglasses, because I thought that was the epitome of cool. Mm-hmm.
I felt the same way. I loved it. It was a romp. But when you watch the end of the first film, that romp, and it's still a delightful romp, the first film, obviously, but that all of that energy, you know, is just, it has this, again, all this dramatic heat. It has this furnace powering it where it's like, you know, you want Marty, you want George to get Lorraine back so that Marty can restore some respect for his father and the house and the place he comes from, which he's losing, and he's losing his sense of self and all of that. Whereas this, it really is just about getting the almanac back. And I say that just not saying that there are not deeper levels to it or whatever, but I feel like that's pulling me along, and I'm confused as to what even Marty wants out of these moments other than to get the almanac back. Now,
right?
Why is that? You know, we're confronted with these really interesting things right up front where Marty's like, come on, at least tell me I'm rich, right? And I'm just, I so wanted the moment where then he sees the reality. Because that is growing up. That's the next step for Marty, is to realize that, yes, in all likelihood, he will not be the next Eddie Van Halen, and then beginning to process that aspect of his future. And which is another, which again would, I can't help, I'm sorry to continue to be fixing
on
this.
You're okay.
It makes me so desperately want to see the 1967 version of the film, because what was the 1960s about other than young people on the verge of adulthood storming out confidently, thinking that they have all the answers and they know that they can do it better than their parents did, and then figuring out that life is really fucking hard, you know? And it would have been interesting to see Lorraine. I mean, it was in that one line that we read, by the way. Here's another fun little bit. Marty dons a simple peace sign necklace, peace symbol on a leather thong. Fine, I can deal with this. Doc, no, it's far out. I can groove on this. Marty rolls his eyes. Doc, aren't we overdoing it? I mean, this is just a simple deal. We go back to 1967, grab the book off Biff's doorstep. I don't talk to anyone, and we come back to 85. Agreed, but so far none of my plans have gone according to plan, yada yada yada. But again, already seeing Marty dress up in, you know, the peace symbol and all of that, it is a period, and this is something I think that Zemeckis and Gale seem to know, at least innately, it was a period that was, you know, about, in some way, it was about change, but in some ways it was about the folly and the arrogance of youth. Mm-hmm. And now that we are having Marty has settled his past with his father, it would be very interesting to see a brash Marty who, now that he's fixed things, now that his parents are rich in the future or whatever it is, you know, he is 1967. He is, you know, he could have been that, but he could have been the 80s version of that, you know, lots of confidence. He knows how the world's going to work. He's going to go on. He's going to be the next Eddie Van Halen. And then he goes back and potentially sees a Lorraine or a George who have similar, I mean, he obviously saw that in the first film, but I don't know. It's the kind of thing where it's cool, man.
And I think a lot of that, just watching some of the stuff that I was able to watch, it sounds like it all kind of came down to the whole Crispin Glover situation. Apparently they tried to lowball him a little bit, and that's what Crispin Glover said. And I think they also said, I think he was wanting script approval because he didn't approve of the what he saw as a very material ascending to the first film.
Well, and I think history has proved that Crispin Glover is potentially eccentric.
Totally. And who knows what the actual story is, because Bob Gale says one thing, Crispin Glover says another thing, and the story has changed. But it's like, and the thing that I saw said, or Gale was saying, that they didn't know what the story was going to be when they asked everybody back. And so that was an issue before they actually started writing the script.
Yeah.
So Well, that doesn't even make sense because they can still have, they still wrote the thing with him in it. If, so I don't know if Gale's story ties together, but apparently the whole like alternate future thing was born out of not having Crispin Glover. So they had to find a way to not have him substantially in the movie before. And the way to do that is to kill him and have him dead. And that's something that Marty has to reckon with.
Yeah.
But him saying that he'd already written the 1967 version got written and George was a character in that. So who knows what the, what the actual story is.
For sure. Or, I mean, even if it's 1967 and for some reason George, you know, isn't around for some reason, who knows? But it would have been a perfect, I think, a perfect midpoint in the series, the sort of that fallen future in the six. But let's not talk about the 67 version. Let's talk about the version as it is, which, you know, being a kid, I just love, I mean, I think most kids, they want to see the, they want to see future cars. That's what kids want to see, future cars. And so obviously two is the best because two had future cars
and hoverboards
and all that stuff.
I love the balls of them like coming out and just pretending hoverboards are real, like in all of the press stuff. So Max is like, the toy companies have had these forever and the parents groups are saying no. And you can tell that they were so confident in the effects, which still there's like one shot of the hoverboard that doesn't look so great, but all the other ones are like, damn, this looks like they work.
No, it's great. I think I encountered that as well, and I think that's one of the most delightful things about it was the kind of mischievous nature of that whole thing, but also just that idea that I think Zemeckis knew that, you know, kids' imagination is going to be a big part of this and a big part of what makes all of these movies work. And so it's like, yeah, you could talk about the special effects for how they did the hoverboard, but if every kid wants a hoverboard, it's so much cooler to believe that it's actually real, and that does so much more to enhance your experience. So there
the,
you go.
The other thing, and it, there was more stuff beyond that in the kind of special features of the time, all the interviews and stuff, they were, he was very, very coy about how they pulled off not just the hoverboard stuff, because obviously they wanted that to live in imagination, but all of the flying car stuff and the how they did the all the Marty talking to Marty stuff, like he was very kind of coy about how they did a lot of that, trying to retain the magic trick for people, which is kind of awesome that it was even possible at one point. And we forget that these, like we talked about it before, he's like doing all these magic tricks with Death Becomes Her. I think he does all these wonderful magic tricks and it's all in the same shot and it all looks great and works really well and kind of affects the audience that way. And we kind of have lost some of that. There's no magic tricks anymore. It's all just giant.
Well, it's like when you can
CGI
literally
robots.
Paint reality, when you can literally paint reality with a computer, people don't stop trying to do clever things in the frame, which is, again, the limitations of technology make for all of those delightful moments, like Marty pour, like the elder Marty pouring, you know, tea into the cup of the younger Marty and sipping. But it was, again, looking at some of the deleted scenes before this, it's weird, I don't often do that, but it was interesting looking at how there was a much longer version of that scene where you would see more of them in a master shot, and pretty much, and they talk about how the Vista Glide Cam or whatever it is, the motion control rig basically, which
that they invented for the film,
was used and was showing off the fact that they could have three Martys all in one frame, and then they ended up cutting the scene out, and I think that. Or much of the scene out, including much of the master that had all three of them, that had all three Martys in it. And I think that kind of, in a sense, and there was another moment they showed with Lorraine sneaking around the house that shows off the technology again that they ended up cutting. And obviously, a lot of it remains in the film, and a lot of the use of that camera remains in the film throughout. But I think it's an interesting microcosm potentially for the film, which is like, this sounds like a delightful technical trick, not unlike the delightful technical trick that would, you know, delight audiences at the end of, those who saw it at the end of I Want to Hold Your Hand, of, you know, making it feel like the Beatles were
in the room.
There.
They're right there.
Yeah, we're really there in the room. But again, all of that trick is informed by these characters in that film, and we know exactly what they want, and we want to see them get it, and it all comes together perfectly. Whereas while Marty is doohickeying, you know, there's not a clear sense that, you know, while doohickeying, I mean running around and back to the futuring at the end and all that. It's not a clear sense that Marty believes that his future is fallen, that he sees, that he's even aware that there is a dark version of himself, which seems almost strange in retrospect.
Yes.
You get a little bit of a dark sense of his future, but more so in the Biff universe, and he's not really confronted with it at any point in the early part. Elizabeth Shue is
right.
confronted with it in the early parts.
And then she's out of the movie.
And then she's fucking out of the movie. So it's it's like, I love all the hoverboard stuff, but at the same time, the hoverboard stuff exists, but they also need to have that moment where Marty sees Marty so that we understand what he's kind of trying to, that his confidence has been shattered by seeing his own future, and he's trying to fight for that future back. And in fact, I mean, again, it seems obvious, but him stealing the almanac feels insane and dangerous and weird and in a bunch of different ways. But if Marty had just seen Marty, the sad, fat, alcoholic version of Marty, and he was all of a sudden, what was his primary concern? And by the way, what would be the best kind of rebuke to the end of to the criticisms about the end of the first film? And I'm not saying that's why they should have gone one way or the other, but potentially being that idea that Marty, his parents were, he came back and they were rich. That's what he wants. And to show a fat, unsuccessful, bloated, not rich version of Marty, is it precisely the kind of crisis that when he's hit with that would motivate him to do something insane, like see a sports almanac in a window and want to take it back so that he could make just a couple of bets just to give him the leg up he would need to get his rock star career off, because, you know, clearly something must have gone wrong, or maybe right. He could say, we must have changed something incorrectly in the past, you know, when we went back to the 50s the first time, because there's no way I'm supposed to end up like this. And then he lands in 1967. I'm rewriting the film right now, Richard.
Yeah, I can hear you. I'm with you.
Lands in 1967, and then he ends up, Lorraine sees Calvin Klein again, and so she runs up to him, and he finds out that she's on this whole other path, you know, is thinking of leaving George because he's too colloquial, and she has all these plans to go off, and she's working on a novel, and she just can't see herself in the simple suburban life. It's just too, she's Belle in Beauty and the Beast, right? That's the character's name?
Yeah.
You know, this provincial life is too much for her. And then he has, and he again has to convince his mother to settle for a loser for the second time in a row. Or it's the other way around, and Lorraine's in love with George, but George has ambitions to be some sort of rock star professor or novelist, or maybe he has a novel that has been a little science fiction novel that has something that he wants to. I don't know what. The point is, Richard,
you're doing really good on this rewrite so far.
We're doing good on the rewrite, and it's the kind of thing where all of these things feel a little bit more like, again, it's tough because we've had, and again, this is not, obviously we had 30 years of, we have 30, 40 years of perspective on these things, and
right.
and we're now able to add whatever characters we want in under whatever circumstances, and all of that, but it's the kind of thing that, it's those pieces that honestly, I feel are a little bit more present in the third one. It would be interesting to revisit the third one, which makes sense if the third one was intended to be the third act or the final half slash the dramatic resolution of the first half, the fun romp that was the second one. I just wish that if that second one had had that kind of internal arc, or given Marty that crisis that so seemed to kind of be sitting out there in plain sight, and also re-examined a new period in the way they did, I don't know, something tells me, and again, hindsight is 2020. Hey, in the year of our Lord 2020, Richard, hey-o. Hindsight
in the middle
is
of an election is happening right now, Kyle.
Yes, maybe that's why it's called 2020, Richard, because we will have perspective.
I think to talk, I totally hear where you're coming from, and I watched it like three times, I think, once about a month ago before we dove into the horror spooky season, mm-hmm. just to kind of get a sense of where things were at, and I rewatched it twice in the lead up to this again, and I feel less drawn to all of the future stuff and all the things you're saying about Marty not having Marty as a central part of that mm-hmm. that home story, I think is a big piece. But one of the things that I do like in how mm-hmm. it is assembled, of Marty just having that, like, oh, well, we'll take advantage of this. Like, even mm-hmm. without the motivation, I totally hear where you're coming from, but there's something about the innocence of, oh, well, it won't matter, that comes from being a child and having this mm-hmm. idea. So when we do go into the dark timeline, like, you finally, it's like halfway through the movie, you finally get that, the weight of mm-hmm. of his actions. Of there's no and quick answers. Yeah. There's no easy street. You have to work for these things. And this is what happens.
Yeah, if there's one part of the film that totally does work and feels like much of the work, the film really, really works. It's a great
totally.
Movie. But I was just trying to think of one of the pieces that feels like, yeah, the Biff world, the Biff fallen version of 1985, you know, feels fantastic and potent, and you know why. And again, I can see why, because that is so dark, and because we're going to generate so much empathy for Marty, and we're going to be so on his side when we see how destroyed fucking this whole world is. You know, that kind of it's, you know, to a large degree, just takes the place of a lot of those other things. He's not mm-hmm. just trying to save his future; he's trying to save his
everybody's future.
Exactly. Yeah. He's trying to save the town. And again, Robert Zemeckis, Frank Capra, it's a Wonderful Life.
It's What's a Wonderful Life, and then A Christmas Carol, when he's going back in time to see himself doing things in the past.
Yes, for sure. And this sort of dark, twisted, world with this one little thing that they did wrong, like what is it, George Bailey jumping off the bridge, and
right.
he goes back and sees the whole world without him, is delightful, because one of the things that it does is it. And I guess this kind of speaks to larger kind of more, you could call this science fiction-y or Rick and Morty-y, but but it's also kind of mystical in its nature. The idea that you see so many different iterations, especially when we go to the West, of Biff, mm-hmm. you see so many different iterations of Lorraine and Marty. The film begins to establish this idea and that is very obviously intimately related to the choices that we make of basically how the different lives and the different bodies that your soul could occupy. You know, we've seen so many different versions of Lorraine, and you could look at it just purely as a science fiction film. Oh, she ended up here because this happened, and then she ended up here that this happened. But we're seeing radically, like, especially with Biff, we see a sad version of Biff, a really
right.
kind of pathetic and pitiable and almost empathetic version of Biff at times. And then we see the old man that's sort of wrought from that and all of his bitterness. And then we're seeing what a successful Biff in 1985 looks like. And you can kind of see all these different angles on corruption, all these different angles on, like, Biff's soul. And if he had made all these different bad choices, he's kind of always miserable wherever he is. His life's kind of always awful wherever he is. It's just a question of how many other people's lives has he fucked up based
right.
on, how successful he's become. Same thing with Lorraine,
right.
with the bold choices made there. And again, they seem kind of crazy. And then it's one of those things that not unlike so much of Back to the Future, feels now very much at home in Zemeckis' filmography, in the sense that this whole fallen world feels right at home from the world of used cars or anything. It's like, it's Bob Zemeckis getting to, in his family film, he kind of indulges briefly in some of those tasteless characters with their guns and their whiskey and their all of that we saw in Used Cars and all of that.
And it's not just Used Cars. It's if you think about that, he directed this right after Roger Rabbit. And
mm-hmm,
if you remove
mm-hmm.
the cartoons from Roger Rabbit, suddenly you have something that's very close tonally to that.
Yes, you also would have a much shorter film.
Alternate. Yes. But like that's what kind of I had to realize is that, and why I think that struck so hard, because I think that's the strongest part of the movie is when it goes into the alternate timeline.
But why is it the strongest part of the movie? It's like, we know, like, Marty isn't grabbing an almanac for reasons we don't quite understand, and he's not getting in a powerful nuclear powered time machine with his girlfriend to go fix something relatively simple that ultimately doesn't pay off. And I guess it's that thing where once we get to the fallen world, and which I think also would have been reinforced, would have, again, hindsight is 2020, by having
totally.
Marty see himself take a desperate action in direct violation of what Doc Brown said, because he just can't imagine himself, like, he can't imagine that he could be happy living the kind of life his dad had. You know, he just can't imagine that that is the case, which I think something that every person eventually kind of confronts. But, you know, it would have made that act. So he steals the almanac, he goes back, and then you see that that sin, that desperation, that, you know, whether it's, you know, saying, like, I don't want to be like my father, I'm going to move to Oakland and stay there even when it makes no sense. Take that, Richard.
Hit me right where it hurts, the cojones.
Yes, right in the cojones. I know. How does it like living in the prison that is California, Richard? Are you hanging in there?
I'm hanging in there, Kyle.
You're hanging in there?
It's not so bad.
You could see we all do desperate things, or people have done desperate. I mean, I think we're all experiencing that now, Richard,
totally,
in the year of our Lord 2020. But people do desperate things to try and break out of the Shire, to try and break out, and they don't want people who do not want that colloquial life. And it would have been interesting to see. And then you could have had him come back. Maybe he restores that moment in time and he returns to the humble Marty that was living in that house, and he realizes that that non-rock star Marty was the happier Marty, yada, yada, yada. You know, I don't know. It's just the kind of thing where Marty answering this question about his dad and therefore about himself is so key to what makes us give a shit about throughout all of the first film. Yeah. And it's so interesting because it feels on the page bigger in this film. It's like, oh, he's saving his whole world. Biff's making out with his mom,
gross,
you know, and all this and all this. And so it feels much bigger. Marty's motivations should be much higher. He's destroyed the entire world. And yet, for some reason, it feels weaker and less specific to me as I get through the film, especially into the back half of the film. I don't know what Marty's trying to prove other than he's just trying to not have bought that almanac. That's the main thing. Marty is trying really hard. He's crawling under tables. He's hiding behind shit. He's talking on a walkie-talkie to have not bought that almanac. And even at the moment he buys the almanac, it is largely just is like a dumb thing he did. Now, it is highly representative of, you know, the type of choice he would make that could fuck him up. It's about money. It's about taking advantage of stuff. It's just such a sort of, it's tough. It doesn't, even when I was a kid, I was like, Marty, haven't you seen any time travel movies before?
Don't you know that? You
shouldn't go back and make sports bets, you know? But if he had just seen old version of himself, see, I like that idea of that version. We're going to rewrite it right now, Richard. But I like that idea of him seeing an old guy who's had a job. Mm-hmm. He's 2 weeks away from, I guess he wouldn't be old enough to be retiring at this point, but you know, whatever, has a couple kids,
he's middle management.
And Marty to be so horrified, he takes this horrible action, throws everything off, has to go back to the 60s, learn about the arrogance of youth, thinking they could do it better than their parents, comes back finally, or goes to the fallen world, does the whole thing, comes back finally, and then realizes, finally has a face-to-face, or hides in the house, and he realizes that Marty, who was living maybe even in the same house his parents did, you know, is actually very happy, and he loves his wife, and he blah, 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 blah. That's Back to the Future. That's that creaminess that we want. And it did, and it was, but again, it's, I'm of two minds, because... Uh-huh. Because everything done formally was so delightful and it was so effective that it's been ripped off 100 times. And the reason that maybe it doesn't quite have the same, you know, it doesn't delight, I'm sure it delights in exactly the same way, but the reason I keep feeling like I want more is now I have seen that doohickey so many times. It was the last Avengers movie. It was Chronos Crimes, or Time Crimes, if you have not seen Chronos Crimes, audience, Time Crimes, Menacho Vitolongo's movie, please see it. What was the other one you mentioned a minute ago? Right? Oh, Harry Potter. Harry Potter does it in the third one, right?
Prisoner of Azkaban, yeah.
Prisoner of Azkaban does it, yeah. And it's the kind of thing, I don't know, man. So, what was I talking about?
Just on how the movie is not quite, doesn't quite feel Back to the to the Future, but simultaneously, yes,
it is. Yeah, it's the kind of thing. It's just like it is so iconically Back to the Future, and yet it's because we're holding it to the impossible standard of the first film. And we know for a fact that the first film was not made for a few years. They had chances to revisit it, whereas this was the opposite. They were trying to, I mean, this was several years later, but still they were trying to turn the thing out.
That's kind of what Dan Harmon said in the kind of new Back to the Future documentary, that he's like, oh, the first one's great, but the others two are just kind of garbage. I mean, they had 5 years to write that screenplay, and they probably had a lot more time
to muse over the first one than they did the second one, writing two movies the back of a big hit.
The more telling thing I think is the screenplay credit on, I think, this one and the second one. Is Zemeckis doesn't have screenplay credit on either of these, because one, he was finishing Roger Rabbit, and Gale had to take the lion's share of the actual screenwriting. And I think,
but that being said, it seemed like it was Gale's instinct to go 1967, and Zemeckis, who wanted to do more of the kind of the film within a film do Hickory, which again
works.
It's a brilliant idea. It's a wonderful idea. I love it.
You wanted it to have more thematic.
It needs both. We're holding it to the impossible standard of the first film, in the sense that the first film is you know, it's nature. It's engine. It's bones. Everything is so good that it works as this delightful Swiss watch of a thrill ride, and with everything at the end and the lightning bolt and all this, and it has all of this heart. That is why people make the Star Wars comparison often, you know, that Marty changing everything there at the end, just like shooting the fucking Death Star. It is everything that we clearly understand that it is everything the character needs dramatically, that why it is hard, and yet it is everything external as well. As above, so below, the external and the internal are perfectly aligned. And in the latter part of this film, we know his motivation is strong, he's destroyed the world, and yet it's harder to hold. I was noticing it's just harder for me to be clear on what he's doing or why he's doing it. And it occurs to me it's because that object, the sports almanac, it feels meaningless to Marty throughout all of that. Because at the moment, he touched it for about 6 seconds. And at that moment, it felt very arbitrary. It felt like a spur of the moment decision. And whereas, again, not to continue to try and rewrite the movie, but fuck it, if it had been almost anything else, he meets old version of Marty, or something throws Marty into a crisis about his own future, and that motivates him to then steal the almanac, and then which makes the world so much worse than what he did. The past he returns to so much worse than it was before. You know, that then it's not just about Marty. It's not just about Marty having on paper some clear motivation or whatever, but we understand what the almanac represents. It would then therefore represent a moment of weakness for Marty, a sin that he committed because he's rejecting the place he came from. He's rejecting his dad. He's rejecting
his destiny.
Yeah, exactly. He's rejecting, and to put it in Zemeckisian terms, he's rejecting the plan that God would have laid out for him, and thinks that he can take control of it, or it's not good enough, or he should be the one to decide, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, and whereas now the almanac is, in the truest sense, and I do this use it in the pejorative sense here, it truly is a MacGuffin in that sense. And that's why I kept trying to, like, Google Gray's Sports Almanac, and is there just some... Is there a symbolism attached? What was that?
I don't think so.
Yeah, symbolism attached to it that I don't understand. Yeah. Of course, there's a lot of symbolism attached to it. Obviously, it's a sports almanac. So it's about taking that element of chance out of life, because it's a sports almanac. I mean,
I didn't invent the time machine to win at gambling.
To win at gambling, exactly. Oh yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's immoral because it's gambling. It's symbolic because it's about knowing the outcomes of games of chance, and what is life but a series of games of chance, yada yada yada. But in that moment, it feels kind of arbitrary, and so it's loaded with you know, it works textually, it works as a plot device, MacGuffin wise. It even makes sense symbolically. The one area in which it doesn't make any sense is the area in which Zemeckis and Gale are often strongest, which is it doesn't make any sense in terms of character or it does in terms of Marty's character. It just doesn't make any terms in dramatic sense. It doesn't. And so because it's meaningless to Marty, as he runs around, he's no longer chasing. He is technically on paper chasing this moment of weakness because he bought it and he fucked everything up. But it was such a fluke. It would be essentially like, it feels more like he stepped off the path and accidentally crushed the butterfly in the Ray Bradbury story, more so than it's, you know, he saw a chance, he tried to reject his fate, and then he's now paying the price for it, which I think is much, much, much more in spirit what It's a Wonderful Life was about. I mean, it's about a guy who wants out of his hometown. He thinks that this colloquial life is not good enough for him. And so if he had seen the George Bailey version of himself, you know, I don't know, it could have, but I'm unsure of the almanac's meaning other than Marty's told us he wanted to be rich. And then even though he's received no confirmation or disconfirmation of his richness, he decides to buy a sports almanac and just fucking do that thing, man.
I think the other path that my brain kind of went in, I think is another slightly missed opportunity, is we have an opportunity not for that almanac to mean something to Biff too.
Mm-hmm.
And because so much of the film is kind of Biff is driving the movie for the most part. Mm-hmm. Like all of his actions are putting us in the different timelines, and they're literally chasing him the entire film. And we get some insight into like how he grew up very, very briefly. Mm-hmm. With his grandmother. Like the house is old and fenced up and like don't touch anything. Obviously he's living under a lot of rules. So we get a little bit of who Biff kind of is, and it almost feels like it could have been, I hate to say, like a more sympathetic like mm-hmm. vision of Biff. Like if when he went back, we got that, and Marty saw like what caused Biff to kind of go in the directions of obviously instead of just it being this, oh well, Biff is evil, so of course he's going to do all of the evil things with it. Instead,
and we get like a little bit more depth with Biff seeing like him that he lives with his grandma and stuff like that, instead, and a couple other things.
Instead, Biff is just kind of doesn't do really anything to expand the archetype that he's playing mm-hmm. in the first film. It's just Biff is the bully, and that's mm-hmm. the extent of the depth of his character.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, I'm not 100% sure I need Biff to be a bunch of different things. I think Biff is one of the characters, and it makes sense because, fuck, what is the actor's name? I'm blanking on it suddenly. Thomas Wilson, there we go. It's just because Thomas Wilson is so goddamn good and so perfectly Zemeckisian in the first film. Like, you can understand why they wanted to just give him more and more and more. And so his character, we don't necessarily empathize with him more, but or add a tremendous amount of complexity to who he was in the first film. And yet, we kind of get to see so many dimensions of how Biff's life could have played out. You know, we kind of see, get to see so many different sides of him. You know, we get to see that, you know, it was never for a guy who is, if anything, just sort of aggressively inconsiderate and self-interested. We kind of see all of the different ways that that can eventually play out. You can be alone and pathetic, or you can be kind of lonely and miserable at the top of a tower. But, you know, but either way, your life's kind of this sort of hellscape where Lorraine also has big boobs. So, which I'm a fan of.
Which was it's a great gag.
Yes.
Mom, you're big.
Oh, another thing, by the way, Jimmy Olsen was cut out. He runs in, there's another deleted scene. He runs into his brother, Jimmy Olsen, on the way into the casino, who's like a drunk hobo outside. And they said that the reason they cut the scene, it makes sense, was Mary Jo Sperber was super pregnant at the time and therefore couldn't do the film, and they said that if they included that scene, it might feel a little weird not showing where his sister ended up.
Yeah.
But Bob Gale added the note that they probably would have made her a hooker. So
they went really hard at this dark timeline
stuff. My thought is, if she was pregnant, then make her a hooker. You know, that would have been the perfect thing. A pregnant hooker in Biff's Hill Valley.
Hell Valley. Maybe a step too far.
That's right. What's funny, though, is that they showed there were all these, like, like fire stacks in the back, you know, that all looked like oil refineries. And it's just so funny because half my family comes from Port Arthur, Texas. So mm-hmm. vaguely in the background, like, of everything are just oil refineries with fire, with fire kind of spewing out of the top of a pipe. And so it was was like very non-threatening, and yet it was so it was used to kind of characterize the depths of hell
the
that they
evil,
have literally yeah. behind like a casino. Fire. They got an oil refinery. They got no zoning thanks to Biff. And then even when they showed they did a great like ILM matte painting compositing shot of Marty seeing that they cut out of Marty seeing his school. Mm-hmm. And it's all like this bombed out ruin. And of course, in the background, it's all just fire stacks coming out or like burning off gases from an oil refinery. A lot of fun stuff. But yeah, I don't know. Like, it's one of those things where you wonder if there had been, you know, more of a pressure of time to continue to compress the movie and make it a bit more of a diamond of a thing instead of just trying to. And again, they took several years, but it was two movies and it took a long time to make all of that. And they obviously were starting from zero. They said when they were making a sequel, they were not planning on making one.
Right.
So, yeah, and it's amazing because how much the film itself feels like the delightful throughout the future right. bits, the end bits. I would watch it compulsively over and over and over again when I was a kid. And yet, why is it that even now, even though I feel like the third film resonates slightly stronger with me, or I remember more about it, and the real reason is because A, ZZ Top is in it, and uh-huh. there are angels from Texas, God's country, and God's country, Zemeckis yeah. has been trying to find ways to get more spiritual stuff in his movies, and finally he figured it out in the third one, which is you put ZZ Top in it, because then you have Texans in your movie, and when you have Texans in your movie, then it can actually be magical. If you don't put enough Texans in it, Richard, you can't make a magical movie. We know this.
I mean, yeah, every movie with McConaughey and Bill Paxton are super.
Think about
super
your favorite
magical.
Movies. They either have McConaughey in them, they have Bill Paxton in them, mm-hmm. they have ZZ Top in them, they have mm-hmm. others. That's what I'm saying. I don't have time to list them all for you now, Richard. But there's always a Texan if it's successful. Don't look too hard into that. I'm pretty sure it's true.
You know, I'm okay.
Bill Paxton podcast next, Richard. Come on.
I'm okay living by that. I think.
No, but actually, what I was going to say about the third film, just to give you the quick wrap up, is just because, like, even just showing Doc Brown, like having a romantic interest and going from this isolated figure to then having a family at the end. And again, I also love Mary Steenburgen. Parenthood was one of my favorite movies. Still is. And, you know, even that. It gives me a little bit more to hang on to. You know, the Back to the Future 2 is like, it feels a little bit more like candy. It comes in, it tastes really good and really sweet and really delicious, and I love it. But it's good candy, too. It's not bad candy. This is like,
you paid
go to a specialty
more.
Candy shop.
You paid a lot of money for this. This
is in like a hipster area of town where like you use a scoop, but not like a poor person's scoop, but like a brass scoop from like 1913 or something, and they charge you way too much. And they're like, this candy comes from Sweden. And
but you
like,
took
that's
your,
probably why it tastes like shit.
But you took your girlfriend, and your girlfriend really likes
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. We're obviously talking about Big Top Candy Shop here in Austin. Is that still open? I wonder. It probably is.
I don't know. Or it may
they
not
had chocolate be. Covered, they had chocolate-covered bacon back in the day. Remember that, Richard?
I do remember that. They had a lot of things. Ultimately,
it's like chocolate covered bacon.
I think
that's what this movie is, chocolate covered bacon. And I mean, that's what I'm saying is I like it as it is, but am I going to have a lot of chocolate covered bacon? I don't know. This metaphor is breaking down the harder I dig into it. I'm trying to find connections between
like,
chocolate covered bacon and this film.
Would I keep eating chocolate covered bacon? The answer is yes. I would keep eating it.
Yes.
I guess
but it's not as nourishing as eggs.
Correct. I think a lot of it too is it just kind of felt like, and I think they've said this, they had to write the second movie to get to the third one.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you can kind of feel, and it gets into some of the marketing of the second one, and apparently mm-hmm. Zemeckis realized this in the lead up to its release. Of he pushed really hard for the studio to release it as like, you have to mention the third one is coming. That's why they mm-hmm. they have the kind of trailer on the back end of the second mm-hmm. one, but he was like, you have to explain that this is leading into the next one and the story will be finished there.
Mm-hmm.
Because apparently a lot of, and apparently he was right, a lot of audiences like just didn't like the fact that the movie was over without really any closure or anything. It just kind of ends when Doc Brown faints and we get a whole bunch of weird cowboy footage.
Which
is great.
Which honestly, which kind of the big thing we haven't talked about is obviously that part two and three were made at the same time, and that that was a very unique thing back then. I think they referenced
the first time
they referenced the what is it, the Three Musketeers and the Four Musketeers as the having been done that before. But but it was one of those things when I was a kid that was just that thing that Back to the Future 2 and 3 did. Like, this was pre, obviously long pre Lord of the Rings. And I remember that. And it was a newer, again, 30 years of perspective here. It was a newer thing back then. Well, we're making two films, you know, should the first film lead not in like a serial television show and some sort of cliffhanger that, that opens up to the second film? Certainly when Fellowship of the Ring came out, they were still trying to figure out that experiment. I remember a lot of people, myself included, and I had looked forward to Lord of the Rings like crazy, loved the movie, loved every second. But when Frodo and Sam crest that hill at the end of Fellowship of the Ring and it faded out and it said directed by Peter Jackson, I was like, what the fuck is this? Bullshit, you know. I eventually got to, but it was very, very it was new at the time, you know. We were very very like, the idea of stories being told across multiple films was new, and I think we continued to learn the lesson more and more and more, for better or worse, in all of these franchise films that have been since then, that every film, even if they are shot at the same time, needs to be a complete experience.
Has to stand on its own. You have to have all the information in the one thing. This was one of my big complaints with Force Awakens. You have to explain all the things that make the thing make sense so you get the end that you... That's satisfying. Or the audience isn't confused.
Yes, or maybe introduce, I don't know, one new piece of iconography for some reason. Just anything. Just, I don't know, put it on a water planet. Just fucking anything.
It's got the lightsaber with the hilt blades. That was the new thing.
That is true. That is true. That was the one thing. Anyway. But the other important thing to realize is that the thing that Back to the Future did was all the rage for a minute and a half, but it really isn't done much. I'm trying to think, is it done much anymore? Because there was two Pirates of the Caribbeans were shot at the same time. There were what was it?
The couple Hobbits, other probably
a couple of the Hobbits. Obviously, Lord of the Rings was the big one that kind of re-kicked all of that stuff off.
Dune two movies now.
I guess it is. Yeah, that's true. I guess people are still kind of doing that thing. I was going to say the last two Harry Potter, Potter was split in two. So again, there have been a lot more at-bats, especially since Lord of the Rings, for people to kind of figure that aspect of it out. Like, are people going to be fucking stoked on this? You know, that there's another film coming in a year, the story continues. And I think that what is unique about movies, and I say movies as compared to Netflix series or whatever, is that we need catharsis. We need to go on the complete emotional journey by the end of it. No one wants to read a poem and then say, well, you'll get it when you read another poem I have coming next week. Like, we're fine reading, you know, things that are very plot-based and very textual that way, but things that are that we're watching primarily to kind of pull us to the other side of the screen and bring us on this, kind of dissolve our reality and, you know, and take us on this emotional journey, needs to be a slightly more complete experience. Now, of course, it is crazy, bold, brave experiments like doing Back to the Future 2 and 3 together and figuring that whole thing out that gives us all of this very arrogant perspective we now have. And what I would have done differently if I had made Back to the Future 2 is... And so I realize how silly this all is, but it is interesting to see that people tried that for a few years. And I guess they're still doing it, but I feel like it was everything for a minute. And then people realized it was far better to maybe just be flexible. And now we have the opposite, where films, they aren't written at all in advance. They just do a sequel, and then they just start shooting another sequel without a script.
They start building the sets and previsiting the action sequences, and then the script comes later. But I definitely think mentioning the fact that he did shoot them back to back, just to consider the kind of process that had to happen, because Gale was supervising the edit and the sound mix and the finishing while Zemeckis was shooting Back to the Future 3, and would apparently he would shoot, hop on an airplane, go to Burbank, go look, watch elements of Back to the Future 2, give his notes, sleep for 3 hours in a hotel, get on an airplane, fly back to Northern California, I think it was Northern California, where they were shooting Back to the Future 3, direct a day, rinse, repeat it was like 3 weeks or a month that he had that kind of severe overlap. But I mean, that's kind of an immense, immense
undertaking.
Yeah, it's like this is why it doesn't get done on that time.
I wonder if
so
he
much.
Was carried from his bed the way tiny Michael J. Fox was when he was doing Family Ties and Back to the Future 1 at the same time. Just Back to the Future entirely. Maybe that's what accounts for how tuned in everything is in these movies. It's just that people were half dreaming the whole time.
That's what, and I think that's why they had to do them back to back and continue shooting, because Fox had an extended break from Family Ties, and they were like, well, if we start doing this now, we'll get all of it in and we won't have to do the crazy months of night shoots that...
Fucking Family Ties, man.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important to note that he said at the end of this that he would never shoot two movies together ever again, which, of course, he went back on with Castaway and What Lies Beneath. Those two.
Oh, well, they're not the same movie.
They're not the same movie, but that he scheduled in What Lies Beneath? Is that the name of the film?
Yep,
What Lies Beneath?
That's the name of
it. That got scheduled in the period where Tom Hanks had to lose a lot of weight so he could keep the same cast or keep the same crew on so they didn't have to go take other jobs. That's why they...
Well, that's weird. I didn't realize that. So that movie was just retaining the crew for... Yep. Okay, interesting. I remember What Lies Beneath will be a fun one to watch. I saw it in theaters when it came out, I think. And have not seen it again.
I have never seen it.
Okay. But it might be the least fresh in my mind Zemeckis movie.
So...
aside from the Marwan one, which I have not seen yet.
So this kind of... The Back to the Future 2 and 3 get tied directly into the Castaway What Lies Beneath thing, which seems to have led to his divorce after, or in 2000 when Castaway and What Lies Beneath were released, which seems to precipitate some personal changes that may have ushered into a, can I just go into a studio and make all of it up digitally and have regular days and see my new wife and kids more. So, yeah.
That makes sense.
All more to talk about.
He was trying
to
find a good work-life balance, Richard, is what you're trying to say.
That's what I think that probably was it with Polar Express and Beowulf and Christmas Carol.
Yeah. Not having to be out there on the street late at night waiting for someone to flip 9 cars over. I mean, it's demanding, especially when you throwing people off waterfalls hoping they come back up again.
Having
it's
going to
cause some stress.
Having Mary Steenburgen reach for the moving train from a horse.
Oh, yes.
That's I love the third movie. Holds up so well. I watched it like a month ago, and I texted you. I was like, this movie's awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to dive into that one.
Rad. I you know, that will be a really fun one to watch because it has been a minute. And I really did dig the shit out of it when I was a kid. I mean, again, it has ZZ Top in it, so it has to be the best one, right?
I mean, based on your all great movies.
Yeah, based on the criterion that I have laid out. Yeah, I'd say that.
Yeah, so then, I mean, Back to the Future 3 then is the best Back to the Future movie.
There you go.
I'm glad we solved it here on the Back to the Future 2 podcast.
Have you watched Sam Dunn's ZZ Top documentary on Netflix yet?
I haven't, no.
You should. It's really good. Listeners, you should also watch it. I watched his Rush documentary
39
times. So I'm a big Rush fan, so I've watched that. What was that?
I said the Behind the Line,
Beyond the Lighted Stage. That's right. I think they're both on Netflix now. The ZZ Top one definitely is. So if you haven't seen that ZZ Top documentary, it's great. You should watch it. Both of our fans who listen to this podcast should definitely watch it, because you can see how they tuned into that deep Texas magic, and they bring that magic to Back to the Future 3 in all 9 seconds of their appearance.
Totally. I do want to make one announcement to you, Kyle. Mm-hmm. I started reading Forrest Gump this morning.
Oh, shit.
The Forrest Gump podcast.
Oh,
and,
shit.
Which I also watched Forrest Gump around October 26th, like we pitched. I cannot wait to talk about that one, too.
Oh,
man. There's so much to talk about. But one of the things that I did see in Back to the Future 2, having just recently watched Forrest Gump, is when they're flying back to 1955. Doc Brown is like, oh, it must be some cosmic significance that has led Biff and all of us back to this moment in 1955, or it's just a crazy coincidence, which is what mm-hmm. Forrest says at Jenny's grave, basically. is it all just random, or is there some mm-hmm. sort of fate, cosmic fate, guiding us all? So, I was thinking of you when you were mentioning your big pitch on spirituality kind of hits mm-hmm. Forrest Gump and Back to the Future 2 intersect right there with...
No, man, I dig it. I dig it. I was thinking... it was interesting listening to Bob Gale talk about what he was. I was listening to him talk about watching his first screening of Back to the Future 1. Because mm-hmm. I was sort of digging through the discs. I have it somewhere around here, my Blu-ray, my old box set. And he was talking about the fact that, you know, and it's interesting to get this perspective. He says that people were still just trying to figure out what the movie was for most of the first part of it. You know, they knew mm-hmm. that Michael J. Fox was in it, that Christopher Lloyd was in it. They're watching it, they're going in cold, and he said that there was even a hush fell over the audience the first time when Einstein was behind the wheel and he disappeared, because they thought maybe vaporized the dog. He comes back, but the moment he describes as saying the moment where he feels like everyone suddenly got on board was in the diner. They reveal George McFly, you know, the guy standing there reveal George McFly and all that. And he said feels like everyone kind of, there was a titter of everyone relaxed because they got what the movie was going to be.
Right.
And you know, and it's fun to think about that specifically. And you and I have sat through a lot of screenings trying to analyze how people are reacting to things. And that was very, very telling, especially for someone who I literally don't remember ever having not seen Back to the Future.
Yeah.
So it was cool because it makes so much sense in the sense that there's so much that's iconic about the DeLorean and the two strips of fire and Marty and the skateboarding and back in time and all that stuff that retroactively is iconic because it all pays off in the back half of the movie in so many fun ways. But the core of the movie, the thing, and so it, and you know as well as I do, you can either get people on board with a thing and they can experience a sequence one whole way, or they cannot be on board with it because something preceding it is slightly changed and they will have a completely different reaction. That moment, you know, that moment in the diner, which is a very subtle moment relative to the bombast of lightning and fire and time travel and making out with your mom. But that moment is the whole movie. Like, that's the moment where you dial in. You see, like, a guy sees his dad. You understand the predicament. His dad's kind of a dweeb. You immediately set it all up. And that moment in this film, like, would have, should have, seems like it could have been Marty seeing old Marty.
But that's the thing, is like, they were on that track, like, because we are in a diner in Back to the Future 2, and Marty does see Marty Jr. So we have that mm-hmm. almost. It's like,
and even the way it's characterized, right, like, he's a wimp, and it's true, he's not cool, but it clearly does very little to affect Marty beyond making him realize he needs to jump in and now defeat Biff or Griff in this little circumstantial thing in these fisticuffs. And again, it's such a subtle thing, but we harp on it just because it sort of radiates throughout the rest of the film. You know, that Marty accidentally stepped off the path and crushed, you know, a flower. He didn't, you know, commit that kind of original sin that, honestly, that we see even in Zemeckis's what was the television show with Christopher Lloyd, Mr. Beans?
Amazing Stories.
Even Amazing Stories. In Amazing Stories, we have a better sense of what the sin that the kid commits, mm-hmm. what that means, you know, in that film. Because in the first part of the thing, we see that he has a girlfriend. His girlfriend kind of walks all over him, but he allows it to happen because she is something cool and something alternative and something apart from himself. She is this temptress, all of this. And so when he ultimately commits the sin, doing the ritual and with the Mr. Beans thing, we know what Mr. Beans now returning to him as this specter means. We know what it means to him. when the bit when the specter of Biff returns, you know, as Donald Trump in the casino at the end of the thing, when the specter of Biff returns, it means that Biff sucks ass. And it definitely means that Biff sucks ass. Like, that's what it means. And definitely don't give that guy a sports almanac for sure-sies.
Well, I think it just...
But it's because that choice is just not... Well, because the choice is not tied to a crisis about Marty's future, really. Even if it had been his son. Say it's his son. Marty sees his son. His son's a dweeb. If the crisis, the emotional state he was in by seeing what a lame-o his son is, who has holes in his shoes or whatever, or
his jacket doesn't fit.
Yeah, right. Like that then motivates him to grab the almanac. Even that sequence of events, I feel like almost makes the rest of the movie fly after that a little bit better, or at least would put us on a path where as he's chasing down the almanac, we're realizing that he's chasing after, let's say in this version of it, the fact that, you know, he cannot control the outcome of what his kids are going to be any more so than his parents could control him, blah, 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 blah. But at least it would be informed by some emotional content.
Well, just thinking about that, what you said, like he doesn't react to seeing his kid at all once that scene's over. Mm-hmm. They get in the car and go park outside of his future house, and Doc is like, it's just Pryor told him, like, the universe will end if you see yourself.
Yep.
And then he parks, Marty gets out of the car, wanders around the neighborhood, and he walks away from the car. That's what he does. And then we have an extended sequence in the home with old Marty and Elizabeth Shue and Doc Brown trying to get Elizabeth Shue out. So there's nothing is being pushed forward at all there. And Marty just leaves the car so Biff can take it.
Here's my proposition. We find the script for the 1967 version of The Thing, Richard. A, we have to for the podcast. We have to read it out on here.
Totally.
But then after that, you and I need to remake Back to the Future 2. All right, I'm putting this out there, Bob Zemeckis. We're going to cast Tom Holland and Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. will play Doc. Tom Holland will play Marty. I once saw it on one of those deepfake style videos. It works. They deepfaked their faces over Marty. That's all I need. Deepfakes are very effective, Richard. They tricked me. And I was like, I'll watch that as soon as I saw it. We remake it. Okay, third act is in 1967. Why? Because obviously Robert Downey Jr. can't be involved in two. Robert Downey Jr. and Tom Holland cannot be involved in two Back to the Future and time travel movies. They already did the last.
They're already in one Back to the Future 2.
Yes, they've already done one Back to the Future 2. So instead, we'll remake that. It will just be about the alternative. This is just like the Star Trek movie that J.J. Abrams. Are you ready for it, Richard? Mm-hmm. Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Doc Brown pulls in, runs over Jennifer. All right, runs over Jennifer. All right, so now we are already in a completely different timeline. Okay, obviously Jennifer is like the Vulcan homeworld in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. We blow that up. We're now in a completely different
timeline. We start over.
Now here's the good thing: she's not dead because I'm not a monster. She just sprained her ankle. She has to go away, so they have to wait a little bit before going back to do the thing about the kids. Now, they don't have an Elizabeth Shue to leave behind and do nothing at the house, so I guess Marty will have to do that instead. So he has to hide. He is confronted accidentally falling out of a tree with Fat and Sad Marty, who is not a rock star, and then reeling from this, he buys the almanac. And then from there, we're on an adventure. We go to an even more Trumpified version of the Biff world, because that's definitely what people want to see more of on screen right now. I tell you what, they're not sick of it. We're going to lean even harder in that.
Biff world.
Yeah, perfect Biff world, exactly. That's what we sell. That's how we're going to get this movie sold, Richard. We're going to be like, we're really going to lean into the Trump stuff. People want it. people want more politics in their fantasy movies right now.
Right.
And then last act, all 1967, Lorraine, who will be played obviously by Rachel McAdams, because she's the first actress I could think of off the top of my head.
That checks.
You know, she's an anti-war protester. They'll love that. You know, Crispin, we recast George McFly, obviously. George McFly is played by Adam Driver. You know, he's getting a little traction. He's getting a little traction on one of his science fiction novels. Now remember, we're in a world here where he's going to grow up to be a successful science fiction novelist. So we're not.
He already has.
This is a big part of it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We know that's true. Marty could fuck it up.
Exactly.
By going
now, but here's the thing. All right. Is that in order to pursue his career as a novelist, George is now thinking about leaving Lorraine, thinking about leaving her, going to New York to go be a writer, to go be an intellectual. Why? Lorraine, she's too concerned with the material world. Okay. She has feet of clay. She has her eyes on the ground. His eyes are in the stars.
He needs to be in Greenwich Village.
Mm-hmm. That's what he thinks. He thinks he's too good for this colloquial life. And so instead of trying to help his dad win his mom back, he's helping his mom win his dad back, in a sense, and brings it all together. But he sees mostly that both his mom and his dad are just like him, very kind of arrogant young people who think very clearly that they could have made all the decisions better for their parents. And they, unlike Marty, have not gone on a time adventure. They have not learned their lessons yet. Now, Lorraine is going to learn empathy for her father's way of doing whatever the fuck he has views or something. That's very now, Richard. People are into that now. People, have an empathy for people across lines. That's good. That's what's going to happen.
Empathy's
great. And then we're going to have our Adam Driver, George McFly. He's a professor. He's slinging dick. He's being Adam Driver.
You get it.
Yeah. He's a different George McFly. He's the kind where a girl in the front seat writes, "I love you" on her eyelids and then blinks slowly. This is all set at Berkeley, by the way, and I'm not making that up. That is literally in the segments of the script that I saw. So it's all very 2020 already. Marty has to teach them lessons. They learn. They come back together. And then in the end, they stop the Vietnam War from happening, even though it's already been going on for several years at that point.
They do make that gag in the film. It says Nixon's going to be seeking a fifth term and vows that we'll be out of Vietnam by 1986, I think.
Yes. Okay. So instead, the main theater in the town, it's 1967, will either be playing... No, okay. I'm either thinking Roger Corman's The Trip, okay, or Bonnie and Clyde, Richard. Okay, why? Yeah, because Trip, obviously, counterculture, and why the same crew, Dennis Hopper, the others. They're going to make Easy Rider 2 years later, completely change everything. But 67, now here's the problem, though. Bonnie and Clyde, limited release first in around the Dallas area, of all things. It premiered around in Denton County and then went around the rest of the country. So was Bonnie and Clyde the big hit yet? Let's just say that it is. Changing everything.
In October,
that's what's playing at the local theater.
In October, maybe, if we keep...
Oh, that's true. We know the date. That's right. That's a good point. So
we can control the date when they
think about how Hill Valley, think about that main square, instead of just seeing it in the 50s again, imagine seeing it with like in drum 60s, circles and like hippies living in the street and seeing the same characters having to react to this new reality. All like how would we have seen how Biff would have reacted to hippies. We would have seen what the town square would have looked like in the middle. We would have seen where Goldie Wilson was in 1967. That's right. Where was he on his trajectory toward becoming the mayor in the 80s, you know? Again, we can't argue with, because if the last half of the film, if they hadn't have gone back into the first film and done that, then they wouldn't have created that thing that everyone's ripped off 25 times. So again, I am of two minds here, but the important thing is, Richard, we already have that version of the movie. I want sexy Adam Driver, George McFly as a professor. I want Rachel McAdams, possibly Scarlett Johansson. They have a lot of heat coming off of them from that one movie that was directed by that one guy that came out 3 years ago or whatever.
Marriage Story. I love that movie.
Exactly. So this what better Marriage Story? They're actually both, I think, like 80 years too old to play college students at this point, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, Adam Driver is 145 years old now. He was young.
He just doesn't age anymore.
Yes, that's right.
He's like Dracula.
So
he's become.
We want sexy George McFly, but sexy George McFly. He's teaching English. He's working on kind of a science fiction novel on the side a little bit.
He's like Vonnegut. He's Vonnegut.
Yeah, but he's gotten a letter back. He's gotten a letter back from New York already. Like, he has this letter, but here's the thing. He hasn't shown the letter to Lorraine yet. And that's what he tells Marty. He hasn't shown the letter to Lorraine yet that he's got that big deal. You know why? Because he knows that she doesn't want to move to New York. You know, her family is here, who she claims to reject. She claims with all of her anti-war stuff. And yet she doesn't want to leave her hometown. And there, Lorraine has this fantastic dynamic internal tension where she hates her father's politics, but she doesn't want to leave. You know, George has this. He wants to move, but he's staying behind.
I mean, think about what we know about Lorraine. Her brother's in jail. And like, so she would be on the protest side as a flower child trying to...
Well, her brother wouldn't be in jail by 67, would he? And this is still on the positive. On the positive track?
I think yes, we are.
I guess it depends. You know, where does this come relative? This still would have preceded, I guess, some of the things. And we would have been an interesting 1967, depending on how much Almanac remains in the movie. Well, we don't know where we are. We don't know what our 1967 is here.
Yeah, I guess he wouldn't be in jail at that point unless he went into jail when he was 14, 15.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that.
Possible. I mean, it depends on whether or not they tried him as an adult.
Yes. But either way, see The Trip. It was written by Jack Nicholson.
I never
starring,
seen The Trip.
Oh, you should. I'm just telling people at home they should see The Trip because it's fucking rad.
Telling me too. I'll add
it
to the
Bruce
list.
Dern walks Peter Fonda through an LSD trip. And it's pretty cool.
That sounds like a fun one.
Yeah. And it was written by Jack Nicholson. I really don't feel like I've emphasized that aspect of it enough.
I gotcha.
And Dennis
Jack
Hopper
Nicholson.
Is also in it.
He wrote it.
So... Yes, in the same way that Dennis Hopper is obviously, you know, a weird angel that represents a bunch of intense, like crazy 60s magic. So you would have had to... Oh, that's perfect. You would have had a Dennis Hopper figure somewhere in
the new
Back to the Future 2. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, you would have had to have... Yeah, you would have had to have had the, you know... The biker version of him from Easy Rider. You would have had the Vietnam version of him from Apocalypse Now. You would have had to have had all sorts of different Dennis Hoppers.
Okay, so I got to watch The Trip, clearly. That's on the list of things to do.
Mm-hmm.
Kyle, anything else on Back to the Future 2 you want to hit?
I don't know. First of all, I feel like the feeling tone of this episode has been kind of critical and negative. It's only because I think we are now, having watched all of Zemeckis' career prior to this, reappraising with slightly more focus and, you know, slightly harsher, a movie that you and I love very much and that we have watched a million times and has launched so much. And it, again, for what Zemeckis said was his least favorite part of the film, which was the future stuff, has been so iconic that literally it has helped, you know, create visualizations that have brought things into existence. It is unambiguously a fantastic film. That's why it's been ripped off. The third act has been ripped off so many times.
I think just my experience rewatching it. I watched it twice, sober, completely sober. Mm-hmm. And last night I just got baked out of my mind and watched it. And it worked so much better when I was baked out of my mind. And I think when I wasn't trying to rip it apart intellectually, it was just like going with what the images were and being allowing me to be swept up in it. I was like, something, he's clearly working on a level where that is entirely possible, even if intellectually some stuff is kind of not where we would want it to be. But
we're not even talking about that's a wonderful, that if anything maybe, you know, maybe it is before this reason that Zemeckis occasionally flies too close to the sun on wings of wax. It's just the fact that he knows he can, using jokes, using just his fantastic sense of pacing, using everything, he can make the viewing experience extremely buoyant and propulsive and pull you along in this delightful thrill ride of a movie. You know, and that's present in the first film. That's present in Roger Rabbit. That's present here. You're not going to watch this movie and be bored. You're not going to watch this movie and feel like you're getting hung up. You're not going to watch this film and like, man, they're really letting the air out here. You are going to watch this film and feel wrapped and pulled in and spit out the other end of it. And it will be, and it is fun, but the subtle thing that I notice, and only now having watched, again, lots of perspective, watched a million times, is just that idea that now, as a sad old man, watching Back to the Future 1, I, again, a lot of years more just trying to make and write and do these things, it's not so much that I recognize on paper that it's the script is better for X, Y, or Z reason. It's just that those things, seeing Marty, the things that are so subtle that when you're a kid you don't notice them. You want to see the streaks of fire. You want to see the silly jokes. You want to see all of that. But subtle things like Marty seeing his dad getting chewed out by Biff.
Right.
Twice. Yeah. You appreciate how much that aspect of it not only makes you empathize with Marty, but gives a specific nature to his dilemma, a dramatic nature to his dilemma that fuels the relationship with his father. And it is the thing that allows you to arrive at the film not only feeling like you've watched a fun, well-paced, exciting thrill ride of a movie, but that gets you there and actually makes you feel like you have, with the characters, changed. You have crossed over to the other side of the screen. You felt ways about things in the beginning. You feel other ways about them now. And even though you can't consciously identify it, you feel like something internally that cannot be articulated has been shifted or moved. And part two is a thrill ride, but it doesn't do that thing. And the reason it doesn't do that thing, and that's what's kind of frustrating about it, is because we love these characters, because all of these interesting themes and ideas are so loaded into the idea of time machines and going back and forth and all this stuff. We saw it in the first film that we cannot help but wonder, what if this film were a thrill ride, but also had that same heart. And as again, it seems crazy. Everyone will watch this and say, well, Marty finds out the whole town's destroyed and Biff's making out with his mom and all that. And yet, because it is not baked into that first decision, that first moment, the sin of the Sports Almanac, because that whole delightful and iconic as it is, that whole scene just feels like its bones are maybe not quite in the right place, or at least not in the place maybe that we, with all this perspective, maybe would want them to be, to make it more similar to the first film that we now love, love, love so much.
I mean, you got to hand it to them. They didn't remake the first film.
They definitely didn't.
They definitely did not.
I could have taken that aspect of it. But right. It's because you arrive at the end of the film, and I'm not sure what is being solved internally with Marty finding the almanac.
Well, think about it this way. What's the central relationship of the first movie? It's him and his father. What's the central relationship of the third movie? It's Doc and Clara. There is a romantic, like, thing that has to be a thing there. What's the central relationship of this? It's the second one.
It should be Marty and Marty.
could be Marty and
his son. Or it should be one of those two things. Or some. And I'm not going to say
or Marty and Jennifer. If the thing was about look at where our relationship goes, and they're having to figure out how do we reconcile the fact that we just saw ourselves in the future, and it's not the relationship that we thought we had. It's almost
That's another thing that is so bizarre because, and maybe this. I don't know. It's one of those things that feels so bizarre to me because it feels strange for me to hear Zemeckis say things like, and Jennifer was in the car, and so we had to deal with that. And I'm just like, did you see the first movie? And it's like the first movie, like family stuff was, I don't know, all of it?
Yeah.
It was like the whole movie. So it's like seeing Marty living in his house, living adjacent to his dad's house, to see where, I mean, they recast
and they,
the part.
And they wipe her memory. They wipe her memory in the thing, too. Like, she doesn't remember any of it.
Yeah. And so, and again, I guess on some level, we are watching a film that was made from what was going to be the first part of a film that was ultimately going to be, that was going to end in the Old West or whatever. So it's very difficult to scrutinize it in this way. But to see, they cast Elizabeth Shue, for Christ's sake, you know? So they recast the parts. So they could have had any kind of Jennifer they wanted. And for them to see themselves, see how that had all broken down, but then ultimately come on some level to accept where they had ended up or something, to walk. It would have been a perfect parallel, poetic parallel to the ending of the first film. Mm-hmm. First film being about changing everything so that, you know, your life can be on the outside materially a reflection of the goodness that's on the inside. And now it's about realizing, hey, even if your life is not a material reflection, you can still, that does not necessarily mean that that is reflected on the inside. It does not necessarily mean that just because maybe the first time we see Marty, he's pulling a parking ticket off of his car and ripping it up because he can't pay it and all this, and we're seeing him lose his job and we're seeing all these things, but they just feel so meaningless because it's Elizabeth Shue seeing them and not Marty seeing them.
And it's kind of just a joke. It is,
but the thing is, it's not. I mean, you see Elizabeth Shue reacting. You see that obviously this means something. This is a bad end. You see that will probably inform her ultimate relief in the third film when she sees that Marty doesn't, you know, flee from needles, fucking from Red Hot Chili Peppers or whatever. And yet, in this film, in this part, it's kind of meaningless because we've just met this version of Jennifer. We really don't know Jennifer at all from the first movie, and her reacting to this doesn't really come back in any significant way. We know intellectually that Marty that things don't work out for him. We know kind of that's what's at stake on some level, and yet it doesn't affect Marty. It doesn't affect the almanac. He's basically unaware of it the whole time. And right. So when he's fighting at the end, he's fighting to try and, you know, science fiction save Hill Valley, like an episode of Rick and Morty, but he's not fighting at the same time to accept a version, to fight back. Because, I mean, it's perfect. He has a banal version of his future. He wished it had been greater. He tries to change it, and he makes his present far, far worse, which in itself becomes this fantastic metaphor, and it's kind of present in the film as it exists, so I'm not going to say, like, it's not there, but if a man, you know, if a man's heart is not right, his soul is not right, he can make a hell out of anything. So the idea is he had a good life and he's made a hell out of it because he wouldn't accept it, just like George Bailey in fucking It's a Wonderful Life and all of that. And it's just that, it's just all in that one. And again, love the film. It's a great film. It is a great film because it's a fantastic thrill ride, because it takes place in all these different worlds. But if it had had something like that, I think it could have also had that big punch at the end,
right?
Even if it went to the third film, it could have had that punch. It could have changed. It could have pushed us. It could have left us feeling, in a way, it could have had the most powerful ending of all three of the films, really.
Right.
In that, I realize that the third film is more about Marty accepting and he doesn't race the guy and all that. But again, it doesn't mean anything if Marty hasn't seen the person he's going to be and rejected it and tried to change it and all that. I feel like we've been talking at this point forever and ever now, but you get it.
I get it. I'm glad we rewatched it, and I'm honestly glad that we can bring this level of I'm happy that we can sing a film's praises, and also it's not like fanboy city entirely over here. That we're able to do that.
Well, that's the thing, is it's kind of hard to, like, so much of Back to the Future 2 has been discussed in the last couple of years between, like, I predicted the Cubs winning or in the fucking shoes. And I don't know why people care about shoes. I mean, I certainly thought they were pretty badass when I was a kid. And they laced up, but, you know, and all that. But the legacy of the film are these
I would say that the legacy of the film
and this does in a way point towards some of the criticisms of his latter films, which is makes this an interesting kind of midpoint before we start to watch some of those. But it is a film of devices, both narrative devices and technological devices, in the sense that it is a film where, and really with the exception of the Biff sequence, the Biff sequence, I won't make that criticism of it. It stands strongly, the Biff world, but it's like it is all of these fun jokes and devices in the beginning, and it is all of these really cool narrative and even special effects devices in the end, which are thrilling to see. And I love the magic trick aspect of it all. So now I'm kind of really, really teed up to see part three and to bring it all home, Richard. So,
same.
Yeah.
That's the next one. I'm stoked to get in and talk about that one. I'm excited to watch it again. I loved it on rewatch just a few weeks ago. And Forrest Gump is coming up, and then, we'll get into some 3D Christmas movies.
God damn right we will.
Hell yes. But all right, let's wrap her up, and we'll see you, buttheads, for Back to the Future 3. Later, buttheads.
Later.